You know, when you're trying to navigate a brand new city, right? And you are relying completely on your phone's GPS.
Oh, yeah. Staring right at the screen.
Exactly. You're just staring down at that little blue line, blindly making lefts and rights, and then suddenly you lose your cell signal.
The
The
worst.
screen just freezes. You look up and you realize you have absolutely no idea where you are, which way is north, or how to even get home.
Right, because you outsourced all your thinking to a single tool. You never looked at the street signs or the skyline to actually orient yourself.
Yes. And that feeling of sheer cold panic, that is exactly what we are here to help you avoid today. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
We are talking directly to you, the listener, whose current overarching mission in life is to pass the MA-15300 final exam. You've basically asked us, hey, coach me on how I can pass.
And we are taking that request incredibly seriously. I mean, we have the ultimate set of cheat codes sitting right in front of us today.
We really do.
We're looking at the official practice questions and, more importantly, the comprehensive answer key provided by the course.
But listen, this is not going to be some boring review session where we just drone on reading numbers to you like an audio textbook.
Definitely not.
This is a coaching session on the mechanics of the test itself. We are going to extract the most critical strategies, decode the underlying patterns, and, help you sidestep the traps that hemorrhage points for so many students.
We want you walking into that room with a bulletproof game plan. And to build that, we have to start with the fundamental philosophy of this exam.
Right.
The course materials emphasize something called the rule of four. This is the core mindset you just have to adopt to pass.
Okay, let's unpack this.
It basically means you must be able to represent mathematical functions in four distinct ways: in words, in graphs, in tables, and in analytical formulas.
Right, because you simply cannot survive this final by relying on just one of those.
Exactly.
But before we even look at a single polynomial, we need to establish the physical rules of engagement, like, what exactly are you walking into on exam day?
Yeah, the logistics actually dictate the strategy here. The environment is highly controlled.
Very controlled.
You need to bring your grounding calculator,
Yeah.
but you absolutely cannot bring the manual for it.
No manuals.
Right. And you need number two pencils, and you need your student ID number, which you can get from go.pfw.edu or directly from your instructor.
And no formula sheets,
No
right?
formula sheets, no notes, no books of any kind.
Now, the exam is entirely multiple choice, which honestly sounds like a massive relief at first.
It does sound nice.
Yeah, you sit down and think, great, the correct answer is literally sitting right there on the page. I just have to pick it out.
But reading through this prep material, that multiple choice format might actually be a weapon used against you.
Wait, really? Like, how so?
Well, the test writers know every common mistake students make, and they put those specific wrong answers right there in the options.
Oh, wow, that's brutal.
It is. And this ties directly into how you should be preparing. The practice sheet we are dissecting today is phenomenal, but a major pro tip from the material is that you can't just memorize these specific questions.
Right, you have to go back.
Yeah, you have to review your previous homework, your EHW, quizzes, past tests, class notes. The final is a synthesis of everything.
Oh, and a quick PSA from the guide. Double check your exam time and location because it is almost never in your usual classroom or at your usual time.
Good call.
So, knowing all that, what is the heavy hitter? Like, what's going to make or break a student score?
Unquestionably, the final chapter of the course. The material on polynomial and rational functions is going to receive significantly more emphasis than the earlier chapters.
Which brings us back to this rule of four mindset, because to me, it feels exactly like knowing that city we talked about earlier. You can't just know the street map, which are your mathematical formulas. You need to know the skyline, those are the graphs.
Right.
You need the transit schedule, which are your data tables, and the history, like the
Yeah.
words and real world
That's a
context.
great way to put it.
But I have to push back here for a second.
Okay, let's hear it.
As a student looking for the path of least resistance, if the exam is entirely multiple choice and I'm holding a powerful graphing calculator,
I know where this is going.
right, why can't I just plug every formula into the machine, look at the screen, and just match it to A, B, C, or D? Why do I need all four representations?
Because the exam is specifically engineered to punish that exact strategy.
Ouch. Okay.
What's fascinating here is that the test writers know perfectly well what happens when a student blindly trusts their calculator screen without understanding the analytical math.
They design questions to trick the calculator.
Basically, yeah. They have designed questions where the technology will actively deceive you if you don't cross-reference it with another part of the rule of four.
I actually saw this in the practice key. The key highlights this hypothetical student making this exact mistake.
Yes, the Eustace problem.
Let's call it the Eustace trap. We really need to walk through this because it perfectly illustrates why relying solely on the graphing window is just a recipe for disaster.
So Eustace is working on a problem dealing with the long-run behavior of a polynomial.
Okay, and the specific function he's given is y equals 0.01x to the third minus 0.0001x to the fourth.
Right, and just to make sure we're on the same page, long-run behavior just means what happens to the line on the graph as it goes way out to the left toward negative infinity and way out to the right toward positive infinity.
Like, where are the two outer arms of the graph pointing?
Exactly. So Eustace does what almost anyone would instinctively do. He grabs his graphing calculator, types in the formula, and hits graph using the standard viewing window.
And a standard window usually displays the x-axis from negative 10 to positive 10, right? And the same for the x-axis.
Yep, a standard 10 by 10 grid.
Okay, so I'm looking at a mock-up of what Eustace sees on his screen. Based on that tiny narrow view, the left arm of the line is pointing down, and the right arm of the line is pointing up.
So Eustace confidently marks his multiple choice answer. He says, as x goes to negative infinity, y goes to negative infinity. And as x goes to positive infinity, y goes to positive infinity.
And Eustace is completely, fundamentally wrong.
Completely. That answer is going to cost him the points for that caution.
It's like looking through a peephole on a solid door. If you don't know what room you're actually looking into, you won't realize you're staring at a completely misleading part of the picture.
Exactly. The calculator isn't broken. It's doing exactly what it was programmed to do. It's just rendering the math you asked it to render within the tiny box you gave it.
So the window is just too small to see the real shape of the curve.
Right. The answer key reveals that to see the true long-run behavior, Eustace would need to expand his window massively.
Like, how massive?
If he changed his settings to show x values from negative 200 to positive 200 and y values from negative 1200 to positive 1200.
Whoa.
Yeah. Then the graph reveals its true shape. Both of the arms actually point down.
But wait, how on earth are you supposed to know to set your window to those massive random seeming numbers?
You don't.
Because you can't just sit there during a timed final exam guessing random window sizes, hoping the graph magically fixes itself. You'd run out of time.
You absolutely would. And that is where the analytical viewpoint comes in to guide the graphical viewpoint.
Ah, the rule of four again?
Exactly. You use the mathematical formula to tell you what the calculator screen should look like.
Mm.
For any polynomial, the long-run behavior is always dictated entirely by its leading term.
Okay, let's break down the leading term. I always used to think that was just the very first piece of the equation written on the page, like reading left to right.
It's a super common misconception, actually. But the leading term is the piece of the equation with the highest exponent, regardless of where it sits in the written sequence.
So in Eustace's equation, the highest power isn't the 3, it's the 4.
Right. So the leading term is the entire chunk attached to that exponent. Negative 0.0001x to the 4th.
Why does only that one piece matter when we're looking at the long run? Like, why can we just completely ignore the x to the 3rd part?
Think about the sheer scale of the numbers as we move toward infinity. If x is a million raised to the power of 4 is an incomprehensibly massive number.
Huge.
Right. It is so astronomically huge that when you compare it to a million raised to the power of 3, the power of 3 part becomes virtually meaningless.
Oh, I see. It's like comparing the spare change in a billionaire's couch cushions to their entire corporate empire.
That is a perfect analogy. As you move far out on the x-axis, the smaller powers just become rounding errors. Only the heaviest, most powerful term dictates where the graph goes.
That makes total sense. The highest exponent bullies the rest of the equation into submission.
Exactly.
So what does looking at that leading term actually tell us about the graph's arms?
You look at two specific traits. First, look at the exponent itself. It's a 4, which is an even number.
Okay.
An even power always dictates that both arms of the graph will point in the exact same direction. Think of a standard parabola, x squared, where both arms point up.
Got it. And the second trait?
Second, you look at the coefficient, the number in front of the x. Here, it's negative. A negative coefficient flips the graph upside down.
So putting those two analytical clues together, the even power of 4 means the arms match, and the negative coefficient means they both must point down.
Yep. In about 10 seconds, without even touching a calculator, you know the true behavior.
As x goes to negative infinity, y plummets to negative infinity. As x goes to positive infinity, y also plummets to negative infinity.
If Eustace had used his analytical tools first, he would have known his standard calculator screen was lying to him.
He would have known to zoom out until he saw both arms go down.
Precisely. And there's another fascinating detail tucked into the answer key for this problem. It shows the algebra of factoring that polynomial.
Oh, right. If you set the factors to 0 to find where the graph crosses the x-axis, you get a root at 0 and another root way over at 100.
Which completely explains why the standard window of 10 was so deceptive.
Because it starts at 10.
Right. The graph passes through 0, climbs upward, and keeps climbing all the way until x reaches 100, where it finally turns around and plummets downward forever.
It's a flawless demonstration of why understanding the algebra is your safety net.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We've been looking at this through a graphical and analytical lens, but what does that curve actually represent in the physical world?
Right, because these polynomials aren't just abstract torture devices invented for exams. They model reality.
This is where we bring in the contextual viewpoint.
Yeah.
And the exam heavily tests rational functions, which are basically fractions with polynomials on top and bottom.
And the key gives us a very grounded, real-world scenario to apply this to, the Smirch reservoir problem.
Right. In this scenario, we have a town's water supply. The volume of pollutants actively dumping into the reservoir over time is modeled as P of T equals 360 plus 9T.
And the total volume of the reservoir, the actual water plus those pollutants, is modeled as R of T equals 12,000 plus 12T.
The question asks us to define the concentration of pollutants as time goes on. So to find concentration, you divide the amount of pollution by the total volume.
That creates our rational function, 360 plus 9T, all divided by 12,000 plus 12T.
And the question wants to know what happens to that concentration as T, the time in years, gets larger and larger. We're looking for long-run behavior again.
But this time, for a massive fraction.
Right. So how do we approach this without getting bogged down in the algebra?
The analytical rule here is beautifully straightforward. Just like with a standard polynomial, the long-run behavior is determined entirely by the heaviest parts of the equation.
The billionaire's spare change logic again.
Exactly. As E becomes a massive number, say 100,000 years, that starting 360 units of pollution and the initial 12,000 units of water don't really matter anymore.
We only care about the terms attached to the variable T.
You isolate them. You take the leading term from the numerator, which is 9T, and divide it by the leading term from the denominator, which is 12T.
Because you have T divided by T, the variables simply cancel each other out. You are left with the fraction 9 over 12.
Which simplifies to 0.75.
And that 0.75 is what we call your horizontal asymptote, right?
Yes. It is the invisible boundary line on the graph that the function will get closer and closer to.
In the context of the physical reservoir, that means no matter how much time passes, the system will eventually stabilize.
But it tells us that 75% of that entire body of water will eventually consist of pollutants.
Which is incredibly gross, by the way.
Yeah, not great drinking water.
But the math acts as this crystal clear projection of an environmental limit. And the answer key pairs this with another problem about sick building syndrome.
Right, where an office building sickness rate is modeled. And when the ratio of sick employees hits greater than 0.75, the building legally has to be shut down.
Okay, so the math gives us the tools to find the limits of the real world when someone hands us a formula. But what if the test flips the script?
You mean, what if we only observe the limits and we are asked to build the formula ourselves?
Yes, like reverse engineering.
That is the final and perhaps most challenging hurdle of the exam. It is one thing to read a given formula and analyze it, but constructing one from scratch based on scattered clues is a totally different skill.
It's like being a mathematical detective. You see a footprint in the mud, a broken window, and you have to sketch the suspect.
Let's walk through the mechanics of doing this.
Okay, let's say a question tells you a mysterious rational function has three distinct behaviors. A 0 at x equals 2, a a vertical asymptote at x equals 3, and a horizontal asymptote at y equals 4.
Where do we even start?
We take it one clue at a time, starting with the 0.
Right. A 0 at x equals 2 means the entire function must output a value of 0 when you plug in 2. Since we are building a fraction, we have to ask, how does a fraction equal 0?
The only way a fraction equals 0 is if the top part, the numerator, is 0. 0 divided by a million is still 0.
Precisely.
So to make the top become 0 when x is 2, I need to put the factor x minus 2 up in the numerator. Plug in 2, it becomes 2 minus 2, which is 0. Boom. First clue solved.
Let's move to the second clue. A vertical asymptote at x equals 3.
Okay.
A vertical asymptote represents a mathematical impossibility. It occurs when you try to divide by 0. It breaks the equation and creates an invisible vertical wall on the graph.
So if the wall is at x equals 3, it means the denominator must become 0 when x is 3.
Right. So what do you do?
Following the same logic, I need to place a factor of x minus 3 in the denominator. When x is 3, the bottom becomes 3 minus 3, which is 0, triggering that asymptote.
Perfect.
Okay, so now my sketch of the formula is x minus 2 on top and x minus 3 on the bottom, but I'm stuck on this last clue.
The horizontal asymptote at y equals 4.
Yeah. How do I incorporate that without messing up the 0 and the vertical asymptote I just built?
Think back to the Smirch reservoir problem. How did we find the horizontal asymptote there?
We looked at the ratio of the leading coefficients.
Exactly. Look at the formula you've built so far. Your leading x on top has a coefficient of 1. Your leading x on the bottom has a coefficient of 1.
Right now, my ratio is 1 divided by 1. So the horizontal asymptote is just 1.
But the clue says the asymptote needs to be 4. So you need the ratio to equal 4.
I just slap a 4 in front of the top x.
You multiply the numerator by 4. Putting it all together, your final reverse engineered formula is y equals 4 times the quantity x minus 2, all divided by x minus 3.
Wow. You've successfully reconstructed the entire system. Walking through the mechanics like that really demystifies what usually looks like a terrifying wall of algebra on a test page.
Exactly.
Okay, let's pull all of this together and summarize the ultimate game plan to coach you to a passing grade on the final exam.
First, your core philosophy must be the rule of 4. You have to be fluid in moving between words, graphs, tables, and analytical formulas. Relying on just one makes you vulnerable.
Second, beware the Eustace trap. Do not blindly trust a standard 10 by 10 calculator window. Use your analytical skills to check the leading term before you trust the screen.
Third, understand that horizontal asymptotes are found by taking the ratio of your leading coefficients. They represent the real-world stabilizing limits of a system.
And finally, be ready to act as a mathematical detective. Know how to reverse engineer formulas using zeros for the numerator and vertical asymptotes for the denominator. Those are the foundational mechanics. But knowing the strategy from a deep dive isn't enough. You know, you have to put in the reps yourself.
We strongly advise that you log into your Brightspace course, navigate to the module titled Prepare for the Final Exam, Practice and Strategies, and thoroughly review the full key we've been analyzing today.
And don't let your preparations stop there. Hit up the flashcards and just for practice sets located in Mobius.
The more footprints and clues you study now, the faster and more accurately you will identify the mathematical structures on test day. It is entirely about pattern recognition.
Once you understand the mechanics, the anxiety of the exam fades away and it just becomes a process of executing the steps.
Exactly. But, you know, there is a meta, somewhat provocative detail hidden at the very end that adds a pretty fascinating layer to everything we've just discussed.
Oh, yes, the AI tool. So they have practice sets, human review sessions, and then an AI-generated review tool called Notebook LM.
The professor lists it, but includes a very specific explicit warning right next to it. In parentheses,
always double-check its math. We are entering an era where we are increasingly handing over our predictive modeling, our crystal balls, to artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
We are letting algorithms figure out the parabolas and the limits and the leading terms for us.
And AI is incredibly powerful at processing vast amounts of data and generating formulas quickly. But this raises a profound question based on everything we've learned. What happens if the AI pulls a Eustace?
Oh, wow.
What if the AI doesn't zoom out to see the long-run behavior that eventually crashes into negative infinity? We might just be building a really fast, really confident version of Eustace.
That is wild. In a world drowning in automated information and algorithmic predictions, maybe our own human intuition, our ability to look at a perfectly calculated result and say, wait, that doesn't make sense in the real world, is more important than ever. You have the tools, you have the game plan. Now go execute. Good luck on the exam.